my first memory of the internet was that AOL dial-up sound and getting on to AOL Instant Messenger and talking to my middle school friends. I will not tell you my username on AIM. That's always embarrassing.
Rachel Barkley is a public policy advocate in D.C. She's what you might call a high-achieving millennial.
Looking back at my 20s, I had hit my before 30 bucket list. I had a really great career. So I was working on Capitol Hill. Like, I was in the room with the president and with the Speaker of the House. And then I met my husband. He got me a surfboard as our wedding gift, and we went surfing together, and we did tons of travel. And I ran a marathon. Everything was going according to plan.
But 6 years ago, she and her husband were getting ready to have her first baby.
My husband, while I was pregnant, I went to sleep in another bed because I was in such terrible pain. I didn't want to wake him up all night. And I WebMD'd. I looked up, like everyone does, you Google your symptoms. And I thought, I Googled like pain in my shoulder, pregnant. And the story from Cosmopolitan comes up. And it's this woman who has a tumor in her spinal cord. And I start crying and I call my husband in the room and I say, I think I have this tumor, this cancer. And he's like, don't Google your symptoms. Nothing good ever comes of that.
Rachel moves on, still in pain and still worried, but not sure what to do. She delivers her baby 5 days after her 30th birthday.
2 weeks after I have my child, I asked my husband to bring me the baby so I could nurse, and I tried to move my leg, and I couldn't even move a toe. And the leg was completely paralyzed, and I just was in shock.
She and her husband go to the emergency room. For multiple days, they're scanning her brain and her spine, calling in doctors, trying to figure out what's going on. Finally, a neurosurgeon comes in with a diagnosis. He says,
you're a young family. I hope you have your affairs in order. You have a very large tumor growing in your spinal cord. It's probably been growing there for years. You have to have surgery or else it's going to completely paralyze your whole body. And you could wake up quadriplegic, completely devastating.
Rachel has the surgery. It takes a whole day to remove the tumor.
So I came out of the surgery paralyzed from my shoulders down, and we didn't know what I would get back, and I didn't know how I'd be leaving the hospital. A couple days after the surgery, I almost died from a pulmonary embolism. It's a blood clot that goes to your lungs, and I coded in front of my husband, my baby, my mom. They didn't think I was going to make it.
Rachel pulls through, but she quickly runs into the next obstacle, communication.
My husband and our parents are texting all of our friends and telling them what happened and asking for help. Like, hey, can you come, you know, house sit the house while we're at the hospital all day? Or can you come help us with the baby or, you know, whatever we needed while we were in this crisis mode? And then at the same time, they're getting all these inbound texts of what's happening to Rachel, what's going on? And we quickly realize we need a way to update everybody. And so one of our friends was like, we've seen this platform called Caring Bridge.
Caring Bridge is a free website for people going through a health crisis. It launched in 1997, before social media was even around, and it has tools to help share information, coordinate care, and offer support.
And so, you know, everyone following the story would get these updates from my husband or my mom or my mother-in-law saying that, you know, this is what's happening now in surgery. This is how surgery went and all of that. And that went out to our network. And then our network was sharing it, you know, widely amongst other people, prayer circles. I had stories of like, we have this prayer group happening in Paris for you right now. We have this prayer group at the Vatican for you. And they were reading this story on Caring Bridge. Before we knew it, I think by the end, there were like 80,000 views on these posts that we did.
It's great to have emotional support coming in from around the world, but Rachel has another problem.
We quickly realized these were out-of-network medical costs, and the cost to return home were going to be astronomical. So putting in wheelchair ramps, putting in an accessible bathroom. We were living in this townhouse in the middle of Washington, D.C. that was completely not accessible. So it was like, how are we going to get home? How are we going to pay for all of this? And we set up a GoFundMe that we sent out on the Caring Bridge and had every single need met. People, strangers we didn't know across the country, sent us like a $10,000 check because they heard our story and they wanted to help us get home. And then when we got home, we had 6 months of people bringing us meals 3 days a week. So we had all of these meals, so we didn't have to think about food.
But Rachel has some challenges that even money and meals couldn't solve. She went from running marathons to needing help just to use the bathroom. Plus, she's a new mom.
My mom would put my baby on my chest. So I'd just be lying there in the hospital bed with my newborn baby on my chest and unable to lift him or play with him or any of that the first few weeks. And so I didn't even know how to start thinking about how does one live as a disabled person?
Rachel starts going to occupational and physical therapy for 5 hours a day, every day, trying to get any movement back and learn how to live.
I'd just be alone in the dead of morning, unable to sit myself up in bed, just sitting there. And so I did spend a lot of time on Instagram. And I found this vibrant community of moms who are wheelchair users. And I saw them posting videos on, this is how I pick my baby up from the floor, or this is how I transfer my baby into the car and then get my wheelchair in the car. And I would direct message some of them on Instagram and say like, thanks for sharing this. Actually, what car seat did you get? When I get home, I need to figure this out. And I would ask really practical questions on how they lived. And I saw them talking about how they dealt with the grief of their paralysis. And I would be like, oh, I felt that grief too. I felt that very same thing. And it was just such a lift to me to see there are other people out there doing this, to seeing them go on adventures with their little kids and seeing that that's possible. Like, this wasn't a death sentence for me, that I could live a great life as a mom from a wheelchair.
These women become her friends, a support group full of mothers facing different problems. They were always there for her. Still, none of them know exactly what Rachel was dealing with.
So I was diagnosed with this rare tumor called an ependymoma, and it's 1,200 people a year in the United States have that, an incredibly low number.
So low that even the hospital can't tell her exactly what to expect from her recovery. Once again, Rachel turns to the internet.
And so I searched on Facebook and found a Facebook group of survivors of the exact type of tumor that I had. People are sharing different treatment options that they've had. And if this does reoccur, there's all these different ways that I could treat this. And some people talking about different holistic methods. And I can go in there and see like, oh, other people had the same side effects. This is how they coped with the nerve pain that they had as a result. People use CBD, or they use magnesium, or they use lion's mane mushrooms, or these different kinds of treatments for their pain that's really hard to treat and doctors haven't had answers for me for. And the emotional side of when you're part of a rare disease group, not many people understand what it's like to be you. And so, when I went to have another baby, has anyone here had a baby after they had their tumor? Were they afraid it would make their tumor grow back? And there were lots of women in that group who had babies after having a tumor. It's so helpful to find this group of people worldwide who had this rare thing happen to them.
So far, Rachel's tumor has not come back. She has relearned how to walk, with new muscles coming back online all the time. And now, she spends a lot of time contributing to the same virtual communities that supported her.
I think about before the internet, maybe I would know one other wheelchair mom who I happened to meet in my community, right? It would have just been our circle that we knew helping us. And that would have been great. But reading about what helps people survive tough things like this, it's community. Community helps people heal faster, have the resilience to overcome tough diagnoses, etc. There's a phrase called the fellowship of the afflicted. And so there's this fellowship of the afflicted online where we encourage each other and found hope in that darkness.
When you hear politicians and journalists talking about the internet today, it's usually about something horrible. But for Rachel, and for me, and probably you, the internet has been a powerful force for good. It is woven deeply into how we communicate and shop and do pretty much anything. So much so that, for better or for worse, life without it is unimaginable. So what if I told you that all that could go away with the stroke of a pen?
The single biggest threat to free speech in this country, in my judgment, is the power of big tech.
Big tech doesn't want to be regulated, period.
It is now time to repeal Section 230.
Without Section 230, we would not have the internet that we have today.
We need to reform Section 230.
Section 230 is perhaps the foundation of the entire internet.
Section 230.
Section 230.
Section 230.
Section 230.
Section 230.
Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act.
In 1996, Bill Clinton signed a bipartisan bill that would shape the internet as we know it. And now, just 26 little words within that law have become the focus of an intense battle.
If these tech companies want the blanket protections of Section 230, then they're going to have to actually do something for it.
This has got to stop. These platforms hide behind Section 230.
Section 230 should be revoked immediately. It's totally irresponsible.
I'm Mike Masnick. I run a blog called Tech Dirt, and I've been covering the internet since before sharing cat videos was even a thing. In this series, for the first time ever, I'm telling the story of one of the most impactful laws of all time, Section 230 of the Telecommunications Act. I'll talk to tech leaders, lawmakers, and internet pioneers who were there at the beginning. Together, we'll uncover how we got here.
Everything that we have today was like a glimmer in someone's eye in 1996.
Where we're going.
If you were unhappy about illegal activity on the internet, just wait until it can't be moderated at all.
And why you should care.
It would be chaos if there were no Section 230.
This is Otherwise Objectionable, the true story of the most misunderstood law on the internet.
Internet is that massive computer
right.
network.
What do you write to it, like mail?
I guess they can communicate with NBC writers and producers. Allison, can you explain what internet is?
The 90s were an exciting and transformative time.
It spans the globe like a superhighway. It is called internet.
30 years ago, people were just starting to get the internet in their homes.
When I'm sitting in my basement at home before my terminal, I'm connected. I'm plugged into the world.
I used the World Wide Web to search the archives of the Smithsonian Museum a few weeks ago.
This new thing was exciting, a breakthrough. But for some people, it was also unsettling.
The government needs the legal tool to prosecute a pedophile who knowingly sends Penthouse magazine to a child.
Look at this disgusting material, pictures of which were copied off the free internet only last week.
In 1996, Congress saw that it was high time to set some ground rules for the internet.
Today, our world is being remade by an information revolution. But this revolution has been held back by outdated laws designed for a time when there was no such thing as a personal computer.
The Telecommunications Act of 1996 was the first major overhaul of telecom law in almost 62 years.
We're going to sign a copy of the bill over here and send it into cyberspace.
Hidden within this massive bill was Section 230. And within Section 230 were 26 words.
No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider.
So, for example, when I started using the internet, I used Usenet, and I shared articles with friends and a community of folks that I had just met online. But because of the things like Section 230, we couldn't be sued for the articles that we were sharing since they were not written by us. Simple enough, right? And there's another important rule within Section 230. It protects websites from being sued if they remove content that they think is harmful. It basically allows them to moderate what goes on their sites. So obviously, as the editor of TechDirt, where we have open comments on the site, we often have to manage those comments. We get spam and abuse and harassment, and all too often we have to remove some of those comments. And Section 230 makes it so that we can't get sued for the decisions that we're making.
Section 230 is so important because the business models of some of the most influential platforms over the past quarter century are built around Section 230.
Jeff Kossoff teaches cyber law at the U.S. Naval Academy, and he wrote a book called The 26 Words That Created the Internet. In it, he explores Section 230's role in the rise of early tech companies like Meta, Google, and Microsoft.
They've all developed their own policies and procedures in terms of taking content down and keeping it up. And it's very much been a market-based system in making that determination. And they've been able to do that because of Section 230. So it's not an accident that so many of the biggest success stories of the internet are based in the United States, because we have Section 230 and the other countries have much weaker protections for intermediaries.
As other countries developed their own internet industries, they wrote laws that were much stricter about what was posted online. Why? Well, for one, their litigation systems work very differently than ours.
In much of the world, you have a loser pays system where, you know, you better be sure you're going to win this lawsuit if you're going to drag someone into court. And here we don't have that.
Jessica Malugin is a tech policy expert at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a think tank in D.C. She explains that the authors of Section 230 had to keep in mind how business-related lawsuits typically go down.
One problem that's pretty unique to the United States is we have a very expensive and a lot of people would argue broken liability system here. So litigation is a huge cost of doing business in the U.S. And Section 230 almost is a bit of a carve-out around that. It's the speaker of the speech that is legally responsible for that speech, not the place that carries or hosts that speech. And what it is sort of a procedural fast lane. If it's Section 230, it's thrown out of court immediately. And that's really allowed for the shape that the internet's taken today.
A site like Glassdoor is a great example.
Jeff Kossoff, cyber law professor again.
One of the most valuable things about Glassdoor is the fact that job applicants and employees can leave their very candid thoughts about companies. And that's what the greatest utility is of Glassdoor.
Of course, employers do often complain to Glassdoor about the reviews that employees leave on their company pages. But Glassdoor can fall back on Section 230.
So they don't say, well, I see this review and someone says that they had to work more than 8 hours in a day and the company is saying they're not, we're going to go investigate. They don't take on that burden. And realistically, they could not take on that burden with all of the reviews on their site because a subset of those reviews are bound to upset the subjects.
Glassdoor has become a trusted brand and community because of the anonymous users who can be candid without having to fear retaliation from their employer. And that's mostly thanks to the bill that was signed into law in 1996, Section 230.
Their alternative without Section 230 would be that they'd have to take the chance of defending a defamation case on the merits in court. The initial motions and possibly having to go through discovery would just put a company like that out of business. And I think you could say the same thing for Yelp. You could say the same thing for news sites that allow user comments under the stories. So that's the kind of burden that Section 230 addresses.
That protection from legal liability applies anywhere users can post content. When we think of user-generated content, we usually think of posts on Instagram or YouTube or X, but Section 230 plays a much bigger role, far beyond just social media.
Let's say I'm renting out my house on Airbnb.
Tech policy expert Jessica Malugin again.
And I have someone stay there and they leave a crummy review. If Airbnb were potentially liable for every lawsuit crazy homeowners like me wanted to bring saying, liar, it was the best weekend of your life and we're going to go to court for 7 years and fight about it, they would never host those reviews. But do you know what is like super useful on Airbnb? Reviews. Because it's not just the pictures that they pick that make it look bigger and brighter and better. It's people who've stayed there. And that you can sort of extrapolate that argument to all the places you read reviews. Amazon reviews for products, you know, the restaurant review when you're traveling out of town. I don't want to live in a world where I can't read with admittedly too much intensity restaurant reviews before I go. I don't want to go back.
Right now, Section 230 is under attack. So what happens if the law that made user reviews possible that gave Rachel a supportive online community, what if that law disappears?
The non-Section 230 internet is going to look a lot more like Netflix and a lot less like us talking to each other online as we currently enjoy.
We need to reform Section 230.
Big tech doesn't want to be regulated, period.
Without Section 230, we would not have the internet that we have today.
So now you know how Section 230 has led to the world of user-generated content that is the modern internet. But that model has recently become a political lightning rod. Santa Clara University law professor Eric Goldman thinks he knows why.
There's a number of societal-wide changes that have occurred over the course of Section 230's life that have taken it from being something that many people thought was a good idea to now being nearly universally disparaged. The most obvious one is what you and I would call the tech lash. This is the widespread, pervasive negative feelings towards the large internet companies, which is a combination of the scope and power they have, which inherently raises suspicion, as well as a number of unforced errors that they've made that over time have diminished our trust in them.
With a ton of attention on privacy scandals, disinformation, and other controversies, tech companies have lost a lot of trust recently. The result? A tech lash.
This tech lash across the board has undermined people's confidence in technology generally, and it's created an environment where laws that are beneficial to technology are now viewed with greater skepticism.
Section 230 became more mainstream really as there were more concerns about big tech.
Jeff Kossoff, cyber law professor and author of The 26 Words That Made the Internet.
And as people on all sides of the political spectrum got angrier and angrier at the big tech companies, Section 230 was just a natural target because it's seen as being incredibly important to the development of these companies.
These tech companies, Facebook, Google, Twitter, they have gotten huge, they have gotten powerful, they have gotten rich on the backs of this special immunity that they get from the federal government, on the back of what's called Section 230. And I think it's time we...
So there are very few things that Congress has control over, but one of them is the statutes that it passes. So if you say, you know, I'm angry at big tech companies, then the natural direction is to say, let's look at Section 230.
For the privilege of 230, there has to be a bigger sense of responsibility. And it is not out of the question that that could be removed.
For the first 20 or so years after Section 230 became law, it was mostly used in cases that involved defamation. But that's changed. Today, Section 230 cases often deal with tragedy and unimaginable loss.
Snapchat sued by the families of 50 victims of drug overdoses.
10-year-old Nyla Anderson died after taking part in a so-called blackout challenge, which went viral on TikTok.
Sometimes the platforms really were fairly negligent in what they did. They ignored safety warnings and hazards, and Section 230 would still protect them. So I think that those sorts of stories, when they keep happening, even if it's a very small portion of the Section 230 cases, that really drives the attention and questioning, why do we have Section 230 on the book still?
Section 230, in my view, has to be rewritten.
I'm not willing to give up and let a handful of monopolists dominate our economy and our democracy.
Interestingly, in those Snapchat and TikTok cases, some of their features were found not to be protected by Section 230. But that doesn't mean that they're automatically found liable for the bad stuff that happened. Both companies have denied any wrongdoing and have not been found negligent by courts since the cases are ongoing. It's rare that both Democrats and Republicans agree on anything. So why are they aligned in their hatred of Section 230?
Censorship is not a Democrat or Republican thing. It's a government thing.
Santa Clara law professor Eric Goldman again.
It's inherent in the process of government as it battles for control over power in society. And as a result, the Democrats and Republicans both favor censorship, but they do favor it in different ways.
Basically, Republicans argue that internet platforms are suppressing conservative viewpoints, while Democrats say that the platforms aren't doing enough to take down harmful content.
Both the Democrats and Republicans want control over what content is made available, but they want different ways of exercising that control. And that's been part of why Section 230 has avoided repeal in the last few years, is because the Democrats and Republicans want different outcomes from any Section 230 reform.
So all those voices yelling about Section 230, they don't actually agree on what's wrong. But neither side denies that the internet isn't always a force for good.
A lot of times there's overlap with the precautionary principle, which is the idea that you shouldn't really introduce any new thing until you can guarantee its safety or that it won't have any negative consequences.
Tech policy expert Jessica Malugin again.
And that sounds great, and it sounds well-meaning. It even sounds reasonable until you try to do it. And then you think, oh my gosh, mankind wouldn't have tried anything new ever. But the broadest but most truthful argument people have for saying we need to seriously curtail or repeal Section 230, the point they're making is there are harms that are caused by the internet and they're not being fully absorbed because these companies are immunized with Section 230. And if we get rid of that piece of legislation, that liability shield, then they'll feel the harm and they'll be incentivized to do a better job cleaning up their act. But, you know, so much of what the internet is us, right? It's people. Because it's third-party posts, it's us. It's not a perfect reflection of society, right? It has its concentrations and its shifts, but it's far and away. And because of Section 230, it's all of us talking, saying, reacting, liking, not liking, disagreeing, all of this good stuff, right? And all of the bad stuff. And I always say, you know, people are the worst and people are the best. I think that Section 230 is a good foil for people who are just sort of finding it difficult to live amongst other human beings. You know, it's challenging. And maintaining the energy to have grace and listen and have understanding and give space to other opinions is a lot harder than saying, let's break this whole thing. But and that's what getting rid of Section 230 would do. It wouldn't be us anymore.
Without Section 230, most services would either exercise much more editorial discretion in order to remove content that might create the basis of liability for them, or they would say, that's not a game we can afford to play.
There especially would not be the smaller platforms because they just could never have the ability to shoulder that kind of litigation burden. And the largest platforms would be more like one-way streets rather than bilateral relationships where people can exchange content. So I think it would be much more like the traditional media, but on computers.
In other words, there'll still be content on the internet, but instead of it looking like social media, it's going to look more like Netflix, where there'll be professionally produced content and large databases of it that we will enjoy and value, but it won't be us talking to each other. It will be someone talking to us. The person who's talking to us will be making choices that generally favor majoritarian interests. So we're going to see a recession of user-generated content as one of the things that we enjoy and value the most about the internet.
But the fate of 230 might not end up in the hands of Democrats, Republicans, or cyber law experts.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Section 230C1 distinguishes between claims that seek to hold an internet company liable for content created by someone else.
Up next, we go to the highest court in the land, where the fate of Section 230 and the internet as we know it hangs in the balance.
The Supreme Court is hearing arguments today in a case that could completely reshape the internet.
The justices on the U.S. Supreme Court are weighing arguments about whether tech giants Google and Twitter should be subjected to lawsuits over some of their content.
It's actually interesting that internet law is now a regular part of the Supreme Court's diet. That is something that's relatively new.
It used to be rare for the Supreme Court to have an internet law case on their docket.
But now, every year, they're going to have likely several.
The court heard two such cases in 2023, Twitter v. Tamna and Gonzalez v. Google. Both were brought by families of two individuals who had been victims of separate terrorist attacks carried out by ISIS. The family said that because Twitter and YouTube hosted terrorist content, they should be held liable for their loved ones' deaths.
It's an unhappy truth that terrorist organizations can create social media accounts. In some cases, those can be extinguished easily. In other cases, the content that they provide is protected by the First Amendment. But social media services can't do much with respect to terrorist content other than the binary, leave it up or take it down. And the lawsuits basically tried to hold them liable for something more than that.
The court had to determine if Twitter and YouTube could be held liable under the Anti-Terrorism Act. Did their algorithms and content moderation practices help ISIS in any way?
Can you help me to understand whether there really is a difference between the recommendations and what you say is core 230 conduct?
The reality is that the plaintiff's arguments were not well made, and that confused the justices.
I'm trying to get you to explain to us how something that is standard on YouTube for virtually anything that you have an interest in suddenly amounts to aiding and abetting because you're in the ISIS category.
There was back and forth about the minutia around algorithms and thumbnails, and the court even acknowledged in real time that they might not be the best people to understand this case.
Whatever the liability issue may be, the presence of an immunity under 230C, it seems to me, is just not directly applicable.
On top of that, there was some obvious resentment towards big tech.
Every other industry has to internalize the costs of its conduct. Why is it that the tech industry gets a pass? A little bit unclear. On the other hand, I mean, we're a court. We really don't know about these things. You know, these are not like the nine greatest experts on the internet.
In the ISIS cases, the court declined to review the scope of Section 230. But it wasn't long before internet speech ended up back in front of the justices.
Breaking news this moment coming from the company Twitter, announcing they are permanently banning Donald Trump from their platform. The president, of course, used Twitter extremely frequently and to extreme controversy.
So in the wake of the January 6th insurrection,
law professor Eric Goldman again.
Several online services suspended or terminated then-President Trump's account. And that really alienated some of Trump's strongest supporters.
Well, don't mess with Texas. That's the message tonight from Governor Greg Abbott. He has introduced a new social media censorship bill.
Big tech's efforts to silence conservative viewpoints is un-American, un-Texan, and it is unacceptable.
In response, Florida and Texas enacted two social media censorship laws that were basically a package of ideas of how a state legislature could dictate the operations of social media services.
This reform gives every Floridian the power to fight back against big tech. Floridians who are deplatformed will be able to sue big tech companies for violating this law.
The laws in Texas and Florida required social media companies to engage in, quote, consistent or neutral online moderation. And if users felt that they were blocked or banned unfairly, then they could sue the platforms themselves.
And in each case, what the state legislature was trying to do was say, you don't get the choice as a social media service to decide how to run your editorial operations. We're going to force you to adhere to a specific type of content moderation standards. And if you fail, there will be draconian consequences.
Like, think of it this way. Whether you like social media or not, at the very least, when you go on, you can see content that is tailored toward your interests. You can choose your content adventure, as I call it.
Chris Marchese is the director of litigation at NetChoice.
Right? If you go on X, you're going to have a far less moderated experience than if you were to go on, say, Blue Sky. And so there are different approaches. But under these laws, every covered website would have had to take the same approach, which is we're going to leave up everything. It's just not the way that the websites are meant to work. It's not the way that the owners of those websites want them to work.
NetChoice represents the interests of some of the biggest names in social media, including the platforms that were targeted by the Texas and Florida laws.
The law very clearly violates the First Amendment. It, you know, compels speech. It infringes editorial discretion. So we sued.
This sparked a wild back and forth of challenges and appeals in the lower courts, with the Fifth and the 11th Circuits ultimately coming to different conclusions.
And so those two cases, of course, created a circuit split, and that makes it sort of a natural fit for the Supreme Court to intervene.
Once again, the Supreme Court was tasked with addressing who should be held liable for posts on social media.
So in the Moody NetChoice case, you're really kind of dealing with the other side of the coin in terms of what protects speech online.
Policy expert Jessica Malugin again.
A common confusion around this is that Section 230 really allows these platforms to keep up content they might otherwise worry about legally being responsible for. But it's the First Amendment that says these platforms don't have to carry anything they don't want to. And the NetChoice Moody case was a little bit more about saying, you know, what's going on with the First Amendment rights of these platforms themselves?
And the majority said, look, social media companies do exercise editorial discretion in ways that are protected by the First Amendment. And even though technology is ever evolving, the First Amendment is up to the task.
And they affirmed these platforms have their right to moderate the content and curate their sites the way they want. That is a form of speech, and we're not entertaining any infringements on that.
In a 9-0 ruling, the Supreme Court sent the cases back to the lower courts for review. But the opinion underlined the fact that private platforms absolutely have a First Amendment right to moderate content without government interference.
It's a massive ruling because it's the first time the Supreme Court has ever ruled on the First Amendment rights of social media companies.
You're kind of seeing how, in different ways, Section 230 allows these companies to carry speech and be safe, and to, even if they take some speech down. And the First Amendment, which isn't going anywhere anytime soon, no matter what this Congress tries to do, is the one that says you don't have to carry speech that you don't want to carry.
So Section 230 survived the Supreme Court, at least for the time being. The cases were sent back down to the lower courts, where more challenges to Section 230 await. Chris says we can look to the Texas and Florida laws to understand how it could have played out differently.
What the laws would have done would be to basically create a Wild West where people could post whatever they wanted. And so if you take a look at like Texas's law, you know, a few months after it was passed, there was a terrible shooting in Buffalo, New York. And the shooter live streamed his rampage, and under Texas's law, had it been in effect, our members would have been required to leave it up on the internet. Because even though it is vile speech, it is still a viewpoint. And under Texas's law, that's a viewpoint that's protected. So now imagine that happening at scale, where the worst humans in the world could post whatever they want and just keep posting and posting and posting. You would not be able to escape content that I think most Americans don't want to engage with. I think folks would do well to sort of question whether they are comfortable with their politicians or the politicians in the state next door or the politicians in Congress making decisions about how they and their families can express themselves online. And without Section 230, user-generated speech online goes away.
If one political party is able to scrap Section 230 on their terms, the internet could be flooded with harmful and offensive content. And if the other side has their way, it might look more like a tightly controlled streaming service with no user content or engagement. It's clear that trust in big tech is at an all-time low. But is Section 230 the right scapegoat? One thing is certain. If Section 230 is dismantled, it will fundamentally change how we express ourselves and interact online.
Listen, I don't want my kids to stumble upon these scary harms on the internet either. Ultimately, though, these kind of regulations can't envision every kind of content.
Rachel, the self-described wheelchair mom and spinal cord tumor survivor we heard at the beginning of the episode, says she's afraid of the kinds of unintended consequences that sweeping regulatory changes would have.
I have not met many people on the street who went from paralyzed from shoulders down to walking across 6 years of work. But on the internet, I found lots of people like that. Wheelchair mom creators on the internet sharing very vulnerable details about what it's like to live with grief and with pain and with suffering and chronic illness. And listen, there are negative things. People post really mean things about wheelchair users on the internet, right? That I look at and I think that's disgusting. But my experience as a person with a disability and my experience as someone dealing with a rare disease and a rare diagnosis and a rare recovery, just the ability that internet platforms have given me to find other people who inspire me and give me hope on my recovery journey. I can't imagine a world where that didn't exist.
Who has a voice in the internet of the future? To answer that, we have to go all the way back to its invention.
The whole infrastructure of the internet was in the spirit of those hackers.
It's kind of funny and interesting how shady characters like a Wolf of Wall Street are behind the rules of the road for the internet.
We knew we were legislating, in front of the Grand Canyon, as it were.
That's next time on Otherwise Objectionable.